Yes, we are on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. I am Mark Haney, and today I have a very special show. I have Mariah Lichtenstern, one of my favorite people in the world, and we're going to be talking about entrepreneurship and specifically democratizing the investment process. You're going to hear some insights from Mariah. We're going to talk a little bit about diversity. I know that you're going to enjoy today's show. And now I'm here with Mariah Lichtenstern. She is one of my favorite people in the entire world, and she is doing important things in the entrepreneurial community and I think in the investor community as well. So we want to get to know Mariah a little bit, but also hopefully get some takeaways from her on some of the things that that she's doing, but also what she sees in terms of changes that are happening. I think her company, well, she's got a number of companies, you wear a lot of hats, but I know that one of the things you do is you advocate for some of the disenfranchised people, trying to make it more possible for more people to get investment and to become investors. So I want to talk about that because those are some of the things I'm passionate about as well. So thank you for joining me, Mariah. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here. It's always great hanging out with you.
I feel exactly the same. Well, why don't we start by, I didn't do a probably give you enough justice in terms of the things that you are accomplishing. Can you give us a little bit of your background and what you're working on currently that you're most excited about?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm trying to grow up and be like you. And you're one of my favorite people, especially in this ecosystem, because you are just rocking. I mean, it's just amazing. I love it. And I just love the impact that you're having on the community. And this just goes to show that when people are able to find success through entrepreneurship, they can give back in such meaningful ways. And so to your point, yes, I'm trying to democratize that through some of the hats that I wear. So yes, my number one main thing, I'm an emerging manager and the founding partner of Diversity Ventures. We are a venture capital firm that has a thesis around social, economic, and environmental impact. And we're also very passionate about capitalizing on diverse perspectives. And so that means not only being inclusive of founders that may be from underrepresented backgrounds, but also helping teams that might not be tapped into those networks to be able to incorporate diverse voices, whether it's gender, ethnicity, geography, veteran status, parental status. There's so many different types of diversity. And the more that you can incorporate those into your startup, the more you can capitalize on diverse perspectives. So that's also core to our thesis. In Q1 of 2020, I had the privilege of becoming an Aspen Tech Policy Hub Fellow. So in that program, especially, and I have to set a little context here because you and I were in this capital region, right? And so we're literally in the governmental hub of the fifth largest economy in the world. Yeah. So you know how people roll here in Sacramento. You get people from all over the state, who's even from, across the nation. And I'm seeing this activity and I'm fortunate to be, have access to some of these players, but I don't even know what to do with them because my knowledge of policy is so limited in how to, navigate. I mean, literally I had to redo in the hub, the little cartoon about what is a bill.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Oh, yeah.
And really one of the first things we did was we read the Constitution, right? So basically the Aspen Tech Policy Hub is somewhat of a Y Combinator for technology professionals to learn the policy process. So over the course of, 10 weeks, we spent like the first 4 weeks in a boot camp, 9 to 5 in a room, panels and just like content on understanding and navigating federal, state, local, private sector, public sector, global policy and what policy even means. We literally even broke down the definition of policy. So we're learning policy through a fire hose. And then in the last 6 weeks, we committed to solving for, or at least attempting to solve for, provide some solutions to a tech policy problem. And so the problem that I set out to solve is how might we close the funding gap for underrepresented founders? And so when I say the funding gap, what I really mean, like we hear a lot about the lack of access to venture capital, but you and I know that venture capital angel investment is such a small percentage of entrepreneurship. But even when you're looking at companies that can be venture backable, the biggest bottleneck is at the friends and family round, and that's due to inequitable access to capital, right? And so I really wanted to know, how can I solve for that gap so that we can actually see more diverse founders? Because I'm seeing these amazing founders out there that are getting stuck right there. And so they're not adequately de-risked for venture capital, because even though venture capital is high risk, investing, we still need to mitigate that risk and have a fiduciary responsibility to the investors who invest in our firms, right? And so, I wanted to solve for that problem. And that's basically what I've spent this past year working on. And one of the ways is through some regulatory change in our Securities and Exchange Commission. And the other way is, through the existing pipeline of angels, venture capitalists, and other ecosystem stakeholders that can help, make sure that more underrepresented and overlooked founders are getting in the game.
Well, can I dive in a little bit on that? Absolutely. So which groups specifically are most underrepresented? What are you seeing out there? You're in the trenches, if you will. Thoughts on which groups are worst off?
I'm going to contextualize this. And this is, I'm really glad that you asked this question, and it gives me an opportunity to share kind of more of my why around this. But I should plug, and I know you'd be on me for plugging, because you're a marketing man, you're a marketing genius. Techfundingequity.com is a website, and there's tons of resources and statistics there. So for the project, the Tech Funding Equity project that I have been working on through the Aspen Tech Policy Hub, the focus is really on those who are underrepresented. And by that, I mean women and specifically Black, Latinx, Indigenous. I mean, it's not confined to those that we know are underrepresented, because there's people who are underrepresented that aren't even measured. Like, for example, until Project Diane came out in 2016, it was a study authored by Catherine Finney to really dive into the statistics around Black women. I mean, I didn't know what I was up against. I saw it and experienced it anecdotally and amongst my friends, but I didn't know that at that time in 2016, only 13 Black women had raised over $1 million in venture capital. So before that, that wasn't out there. So we know that.
But what's that number again?
At the time, it was, and this is 2016 when it first came out, there were 13 Black women who had raised over $1 million in venture capital.
Total, and it's like in the history of time.
Yeah. And it was like 0.006%, maybe even less of VC funding had actually gone to Black women. And when you looked at the Black women who had, the average raise of Black female founders, it was like 36,000 compared to, read the study, but I think it was like compared to like 1.2 million or 2 million for their white male counterparts whose companies had failed. And so it's just a matter of like, funding is not even going into, qualified, female founders that are out there. And now since that time, the number has gone up, and Catherine Finney just put out the latest Project Diane for 2020. And I think it's around 30 something, just under 40 that have raised over $1 million. So it's a growing list, but certainly not enough, especially considering the representation of really high quality women of color, Black women specifically, that are in venture capital. So that's kind of what I mean. But you'll see, even when you look at people who are considered like overrepresented, like when you look at the Asian population, like Indian or East Asian, you see that, women are still largely underrepresented. There was a recent study that came out that was showing like the dearth of Middle East, North Africa women. So, and this is both on the founder side and on the venture capital side. And we've got all this other data that's now come out. Thank God people have actually started studying this and publishing the data. But investors tend to invest in people that are like them, people that they know, people that are in the same geographic area, that have the same, alma mater. And that's just natural human behavior. But it also creates inefficiencies in our outcomes because we're not capitalizing on diverse perspectives. And we have the data to know that you eliminate groupthink, whether it's in the jury or in the boardroom or in day-to-day operations. You might have short-term inefficiency, as you get used to processing the cognitive dissonance and discomfort that can come with processing diverse perspectives. But ultimately, you're making better business decisions. And once you get to a point where you recognize that value, it really isn't a painful process. It's very rewarding, especially because you're all winning together because you're valuing and accepting and incorporating those diverse perspectives.
So you mentioned that the bottleneck is at that friends and family around these very early stage companies that they're not, are they necessarily venture bound, or are they, could it be like a Main Street type company that sort of gets stuck too because they're less likely to get bankable and that kind of thing?
It happens with both. You know, my emphasis being in venture capital and in the tech industry is on, you know, scalable tech enabled companies. And so, but it plays out across the board. And here's why, Mark. I mean, the history of our country is what it is. Our country is a dream, right? We are an aspirational country. We're constantly striving towards a more perfect union, but it's a country that's in our hands and for which blood has literally been shed from day one to establish, right? And so, you know, we are a constant work in process. And I think that, you know, one thing we've learned regardless of your political leanings is that we have to continue to work at preserving our democracy and the American dream, right? But we know that we've had imperfections. You know, I'm listening to Barack Obama's memoirs and he talks about, you know, his own failings and some of the things, you know, some of the times where America falls short of our ideals, but we still hold true that we, the people, can contribute to a better union. But we know that historically, specifically, you know, women and Black people, probably Black people more than anyone on the planet, have just really been dealt a pretty hard deck, right? And, you know, I remember coming up in an era when California was eliminating affirmative action. And, you know, people would say, you know, when I was in UC Berkeley, I came in class of 97. I graduated from high school in 97, and everybody would just say all this stuff about affirmative action and me not, you know, belonging there. There's, you know, like this assumption, right? And they would say, oh, you're playing the race card. I'm like, I'm playing the card I'm dealt. I didn't deal me no race card. I think, you know, I'm just here trying to make a better life like everyone else. But this is the history of our country. We just, it is what it is. And we're trying to dig our way out of it. But, you know, going back to, you know, a short time after emancipation, we had a stock market crash in 1929, and we went into a Great Depression. And during that time, there were policies put in place that set the wealth gap as it exists today. And so, you know, the main cause of that wealth gap is because of redlining in real estate, right? I mean, it's what economists, you know, point to when looking at the current wealth gap. And we're talking about like a 10x plus difference between like Black household income and white household income. And it directly relates, there's a wonderful book called The Color of Law. It directly correlates to, you know, real estate being passed down, people being able to take equity out of their homes and invest in education, people being stuck in areas where real estate didn't appreciate, not being able to get loans, not being able to, like, you know, renovate their homes, all these dynamics that were codified by the Federal Housing Authority and the Homeowners Loan Corporation, which were formed in the same year as the Securities and Exchange Commission, 1934. And so during that time, there was so much racial unrest with race riots. We had, you know, the burning down of Tulsa, Rosewood, but there were Black Wall Streets across the nation. They were being targeted, they were being destroyed, they were being dismantled. And it continued over the course of time, but this was a very turbulent time back in the Great Depression. And what we'd also seen is the release of this movie, The Birth of a Nation, that had come out, and it had reinvigorated the KKK. So there was just, and then, you know, there's different immigrant populations coming in, trying to assimilate into this notion of whiteness. It was just, it was a lot going on in this, mm-hmm. this American, you know, melting pot that's really like a tossed salad with yep. some dressing on top, right? And so, you know, we had FDR come in and put together all of these, you know, organizations within the government to recover, like your National Recovery Association or agency rather. And so like these policies that went into place were somewhat of a consolation or appeasement, because at this time, Black people were allowed to benefit from some of the stopgaps that were put in place for the Great Depression to respond to the Great Depression, kind of like what we're dealing with now with the CARES Act, right? It was kind of the same environment during the Great Depression. And so, you know, on the surface, they were benefiting from these social safety nets, but below, you know, we had at that time, and not to be partisan or anything like that, but at the time, a lot of the racists in this country were in the Democratic Party. That's just where they lived. The Southern Democratic Party was very strong. And Black people had been, you know, very heavily in the Republican Party because that's where the right to vote was advocated for. But during the Great Depression, you saw migration over to the Democratic Party from Black people because they needed, you know, they were trying to survive. It's soup kitchen, yes, kitchen era, right? And so, you know, while this was happening on the surface, you also had FDR who had to pander to these benefactors, right? There were these rich Southern Democrats, and they did not want to see Black people empowered. And so even when you look at fast forward to the 60s, when Lyndon Johnson passed the, you know, the Civil Rights Act and the Fair Housing Act that made redlining illegal, you know, the thing that causes wealth, mm-hmm, gap. One of the things that he said is, I've lost the Republican Party. I fear that I've lost the Republican Party for the next 20 years. So, you know, or he said, I fear I've lost the South to the Republican Party for the next 20 years. So these are the kind of dynamics that were going on, where you had this subtle, covert economic engineering. So if you were a white person, you could become, let me rewind here. So what happened with the SEC, the same year that these other organizations were formed that created redlining, you had a very covert form of redlining happening in the startup space through the accredited investor definition. So basically what that is, it's a rule based on the laws that were passed at that time that says if you don't make over $200,000 a year or have over $1 million in net worth, and there's a few other nuances that have changed recently around having securities licenses or being part of a certain profession, you cannot invest in these early stage startups. And they've opened it up a little bit over the years. Like now we have crowdfunding, but you still have separate and unequal access to offerings and being able to invest. So for example, if you're not an accredited investor, you can't invest in what's called a Reg D 506C offering at all. And that's kind of like a form of crowdfunding, but only to accredited investors, right?
Right.
So basically there was this status put in place, which means if you make a certain kind of income, you have advantages that are denied to other Americans in terms of being able to buy a stock in a company at its earliest stages, where it could be, you know, a fraction of a cent for a share. You'd be hard pressed even with crowdfunding to find a company that has an offering of less than 50 cents a share. Trust me, I look. And so basically you had people that were excluded from investing in businesses within their communities, investing in a lot of ways and before the Jobs Act. And the Jobs Act kind of moved us a little bit forward, but nowhere near where we need to be. And so, this was a kind of covert redlining that's been in place since the 30s.
Well, let's talk about, you obviously spent some time thinking about how we might solve today's problems in terms of inequality. What do you have proposals that you're thinking you want to press forward? Is that something that your organization is doing, is pressing forward an agenda to make this access to capital more equal?
Yes, absolutely. And so one of the things that I found during my research on this tech funding equity project is that this is something, even though we have these racialized roots, it affects us all. We lose over 9 million jobs and $300 billion in collective net income in this country because of these discriminatory financing practices that exist from, you know, accredited investor bootstrapping to, you know, VC and loans and all other forms of capital. So we're all impacted. We also have a study that came out recently by McKinsey and Company that says closing the racial wealth gap can add over $1 trillion to our economy and increase our GDP 5 to 7% within 10 years. And that's even before the pandemic came out that they had this analysis, right? And so again, these aren't things that specifically benefit just people of color, just women. They impact us all. So we've really been sold like a bad bill of goods, you know, in taking this short-term, you know, seeming advantage for a certain group of people. It really has disadvantaged us all, but it's maintained power in a very concentrated group. And guess what? When you have power that's predictable like that, it preserves a certain kind of status quo, right? Because when, you know, economic impact shifts, you know, then there's these variables. And unfortunately, when you have, the kind of dynamics that we do in this country, some people fear that, right? And so, yes, what I am advocating for is number one, that we allow investors to self-verify that they are accredited. It makes no sense. And in fact, we're looking into the constitutionality under the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause. It makes no sense that the SEC can tell me, you know, how to invest my money, where I can invest in the stock market, which could crash, you know, any day. This is what happened in 1929, right? I can invest in the stock market on margin, with margin, which is a form of,
you know, I'm thinking about that because, I mean, some of the problems, many of the problems were were intentionally created because of racism and bigotry and all that. That, you know, that's our history, as you mentioned. That's the melting pot we live in. I think today, and while it's not anywhere close to perfect, you know, we've come a long way. And the idea that you just brought up about investors being able to self-verify, I mean, I would think that most of the population today would say yeah, and they would say yeah regardless of how they might feel about inequality. They just think that that's, I mean, there's a lot of people that are disenfranchised because they don't have access to invest into these angel. There's all kinds of great startups that people aren't investing into because they're not, you know, it's hard to become an accredited investor. Hard, exactly. Meaning there's friction in that.
Absolutely. And there shouldn't be friction. And again, it's really, when you think about it, it's discriminatory, right? For the government to tell me whether or not I qualify. I mean, just think of any other situation. They're not going to tell you you can't go to Vegas. They're not going to tell you you can't buy Louis Vuitton shoes. They're not going to tell you you can't buy a house you can't afford or a car that you can't afford. They're not going to tell you that. And so, you know, there are people who, even like me, now, mind you, I'll give a little history. I was formerly FINRA licensed. So I took these FINRA exams, some of which are now, you know, now allowed to become an accredited investor. And they're expensive, they're time consuming, they're meant for professionals who are sponsored most of the time by an organization. But I held these, you know, and so, you know, but at the same time, I remember before I was FINRA licensed, you know, I had some access by virtue of being from the Bay Area to startups, but I wasn't able to invest in them. And so I was relegated to the public market, where when I went to grad school and couldn't have, you know, didn't really have the time to follow all the stocks and everything, you know, I trusted an advisor and they churned my account. And so that partly influenced my decision to learn how to invest myself. But
I mean, in this challenge in terms of accredited investors and only a few people getting access to these great companies, I mean, it was just on CNBC this morning. I mean, I invested, I was able to get in the IPO of Facebook. I was able to get in on the IPO of Airbnb, right? These things, you know, have done pretty well. I mean, Airbnb is brand new, but most people, if you don't have a pretty good brokerage account, you can't even get in on an IPO. So now you've really narrowed. I mean, even the casual stock market investor with a 401k, he or she can't get in on an IPO. So it's right. Amazing how, the world has put up these barriers, but yet I believe all of us really want to democratize it and make it so that anybody can invest into early stage minority type companies or early stage or even an IPO.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, some people really like me believe that, like I did, I bought in hook, line and sinker that, you know, investors needed protection because I assumed that our government really was protecting us. The SEC has a mandate to provide investor protections and create efficient and fair markets. They have basically three mandates. But when I really got into looking at it and how it had disadvantaged, you know, me personally and how it was impacting our not only communities where you see underrepresented founders or investors, but our whole economy at large, you know, I had to question some of those things that I just assumed were true. That this is not a protection. It is a discrimination. So you can invest. Anyone can invest in the public market. There are some exceptions in what you can get into. But if you're not accredited, you're limited to crowdfunding or being one of like 35 non-accredited investors in a certain type of deal that can't be publicized. And so, you know, first of all, it's not like everyone has access to startup deals. You kind of have to be a little bit sophisticated in the first place to even get access, right? And people are going to tend to offer to people that they feel are successful. So, you know, if you have a level of success to where you're going to see this type of offering that non-accredited investors are currently restricted or limited from, you know, chances are you have access to attorneys and CPAs and other people who are also sophisticated or more sophisticated than you are. So we really should have as much freedom to invest in the private market as we should on the public. You mentioned, you know, the recent IPOs that happened. Was Airbnb, was it $139 a share? If you wanted to put $5,000 into that, you can get like 35 shares. You know, if you invest an equal amount into, you know, hedging your bets with a private investment that's brand spanking new, friends and family round, you know, if it's a 5 cents a share, you can get a multitude more. And to get the same return, you know, Airbnb, like to get $1 million return, Airbnb would have to be in the tens of thousand range, whereas a brand new startup would only have to go up to like $10 a share to return a million.
There's definitely a risk reward scenario. Well, let me tell you about something we're doing, and there may be some overlapping in the policies and I guess for sure the philosophies that that you're working to to make possible with democratizing this investment. It seems like a very minor, not minor, maybe it's very major to have people self-report whether they're accredited or not. That seems pretty minor, I like the idea of just lowering the threshold personally, but to become an accredited investor. And for anybody who's listening, maybe you can would you help us understand the minimum net worth or the minimum income that you need in order to just to get into, become an angel investor or become an accredited investor technically?
Yes. So right now it is as an individual, you have to make $200,000 a year for at least 2 years and be expected to continue making that, or $300,000 a year for a household, which now, includes, same sex unions, or you have to have over $1 million in net worth, excluding your personal residence, which is the change that was made less than 15 years after the Fair Housing Act made redlining illegal. So once people started being able to start developing wealth in their own residence, in their personal residence, that was excluded. So right now that's how it stands. And you can also become accredited if you hold a Series 7, 82 or 65, I believe, FINRA licenses, or if you are, say, a venture capitalist. So there's a few exceptions.
So one of the things we're working on here at Haney Biz, so I think I'm invested into 50 companies here locally, and I've been sort of dabbling, I guess, but relentlessly focused on Sacramento. To me, that's my impact investing. You know me, I'm kind of into the veteran community, and I'm into my hometown of Sacramento. But I highly believe in diversifying my portfolio with as many women founders and people of color. And so I've really attempted to do that, but I'm only at 50. So it's something I haven't, I don't necessarily run in the same circles that put those deals in front of me, but that's something that I plan to do more of and put myself out there. However, thinking about the Sacramento Growth Factory, one of the things, so this is going to be basically an accelerator / fund, and we're in the planning stages today, relentlessly focused on Sacramento, to help get them that early stage help that they need, the financial capital, the other kinds of capital that that we have here in the region to try to propel these next generation of entrepreneurs. But one of the things that I think makes what we're trying to do very, very different is we're going to try to get some of that money off the sidelines. So you talked about these qualifications in order to become an accredited investor. You need to be worth a million or two. You got to make $200,000 or $300,000 a year. These are thresholds that really a lot of people who don't angel invest, they meet those thresholds today. Even though I think that they should be lowered, I think it should be a lot more open. Today, there are a lot of people entrepreneurs that, in the Entrepreneurs Organization of Sacramento, even the firefighters and the police officers and the people that work at Intel, there's a lot of those people that that meet that minimum standard, today's
don't
minimum.
Don't know how to invest in the asset class.
There's thousands of them, but they're on the sidelines, right? So with the Sacramento Growth Factory, my hope is to find all those people who are on the sidelines and say, come on in. Let's help you wade into these waters. It is more risky. You do probably need to invest into a wide range of early stage companies because there's a lot of risk.
Yeah.
But as you said, Mariah, the upside can be, a 10X is not that uncommon, right? These are things that happen all the time in startup world, where in the public markets, It's not happened quite as much. So that's
right. You mentioned an important point that I just want to underscore really quickly, and that's around diversification, right? And right now, non-accredited investors can invest in private companies through Reg CF crowdfunding, but they can invest in vehicles that would diversify or allow like an emerging manager like myself to actually help them pick people who help startups build their companies, who advise, you know, like right now, a venture capital firm cannot crowdfund.
Right.
And so like, why is it that, and this is how contradictory and hypocritical these rules and regulations are, this patchwork, as even the SEC commissioners call it, that you can invest directly into a single startup, but can't diversify by investing into a VC firm managed by someone who understands the asset class.
It's crazy. It needs to be more freedoms need to be allowed. But so I appreciate what you're working on. Okay, so I nailed down. Emphasized the one area there, the accredited investor area, where you believe there's some there's movement that could be had, because there's no reason to come up with policies that are going to get shot down from the first second. So that one seems like an easier one.
So on August 26th, the SEC made some changes. They've said, hey, we're still listening. Under Dodd-Frank, every 4 years, this rule must be revisited, but you don't have to wait 4 years. So we actually have a petition. It's at techfundingequity.com. Please go and sign the petition. We're just now starting to really build momentum on that and put it out there. So please go and sign. And mind you, this can be done by hosting a form on the SEC's website that issuers must have. Just like if you're doing a certain type of offering with only accredited investors, you have to prove that they're accredited. Well, the SEC can say, hey, issuers, you have to have non-accredited investors sign this document that they certify that they are self-accredited, that they are sophisticated enough, they understand the risks. And then you know that the proper disclosures are being made, that the capital is at risk, that it may not be as liquid. But guess what? With liquidity comes volatility. And we know that if you're investing for retirement or something like that, a good diversified option in the private sector can literally potentially close the wealth gap within one generation. So I applaud you for looking to get more people off the sidelines, because people want to preserve wealth too. And I think that we could absolutely partner, especially on our opportunity pledge side, where we're supporting organizations like yours that are looking to, you know, close the gap in terms of access to diversified deal flow, recognize maybe cultural barriers. We've provided a framework and an assessment, and we really made this so that people aren't just, you know, taking a pledge, putting on a badge and saying, hey, I did a good job, but really sticking with it over the course of time to build an inclusive culture that can capitalize on these diverse perspectives. And we've actually partnered with a female-founded, VC-backed local company that came out of the Fourth Wave Female Founder Accelerator. That's M-Train, founded by Janine Yancey, former, you know, Cal Bear. She was an employment lawyer for some of the biggest tech companies, Google and others. And they're one of our technology partners on the Tech Funding Equity Project on the Opportunity Pledge side to support startups. We have a startup assessment for startups to capitalize on diverse perspectives for investors, venture capitalists, angels, limited partners that invest in venture capitalists to implement this framework that was developed by a psychologist out of the UN and that worked with USAID to combat modern day slavery that is like highly driven by tech companies. So it's a framework that has been tried and tested in other sector, and we're really excited about rolling that out. And I would love to have you as a signatory.
Yeah, I would love to be involved and learn more and partner. I'd partner with you on anything, but that sounds very, very much a place where we're aligned. Now, maybe I'll keep marching through. We have about 10 minutes left. And so I want to make sure that I cover other things that are important to you. And also, hopefully, you know, as we think about who might be listening to this, we have investors that may be listening, potential people that might be coming off the sidelines, maybe even newer angels. But we also probably have a lot more entrepreneurs or people who are thinking about starting their own business. And, you know, some of what we talked about might even be, I don't want to say over their head, but like this is new territory for them, maybe in terms of talking about accredited investors. So maybe anything else that we might want to talk about that's geared toward the investors. And then maybe we can switch over and start talking about how to, you know, I know that this directly helps entrepreneurs, but what can entrepreneurs do about their situation? So other thoughts?
Well, you know, first of all, you know, we can walk and chew gum and we can solve complex problems, even though we like to simplify things. I always point to, like, in Silicon Valley, you say diversity. And up until the, you know, this summer and the unfortunate events around George Floyd and others, you know, diversity just meant women. You know, and so that's what they were willing to wrap their heads around at the time. But we can solve this complex problem. So founders, they can absolutely sign the petition, which is going to the SEC. And we've got other fund managers and founders that are coming on to sign the petition and share it with their communities. I would love to have people sign up to actually share it out and help people understand. Because a big problem why this keeps continuing is because we've lost cultural memory. We're not active in the policy making process. We don't know what our rights are. We think, oh, these are the rules. I have to fit within the rules. And we don't understand that we, the people, make the rules that work for us. And if we've got all of Americans suffering because of these discriminatory financing practices and opportunities being, you know, centered in the hands of a few, then we need to say these rules need to change. So that's one thing. And then also, you know, just, you know, startups that have already raised capital or that are just in the game and are building out their teams, you know, you want to be more fundable. You want to be more competitive, right? You want to be able to grow a really positive company with diverse perspectives included, right? And that's something where even the NASDAQ recently came out and put forth a proposal to the SEC around diversifying boards for publicly listed companies. So they're asking if you don't have, you know, women or people of color, LGBTQ plus on your board at all, that you can't list. That's what they're proposing. And this is not just like some like, oh, let's all make ourselves feel better about being inclusive. There is a lot of data around why this is an imperative for us. We need to be open to different views. It makes us strong. This is what our benefit and privilege and strength as American people are. So these are just some things that you can do. And we support founders again with, we've released a culture coach assessment and working with M-Train, we can help companies to build diverse and inclusive cultures to understand the benefit of that. For investors, we support you in tapping into that deal flow with this process. You know, I'm super excited about co-investing opportunities with potential LPs and just helping people get in the game. So, you know, like you, I'm an emerging manager, I'm an investor. And so, you know, we have our fund that we're working, you know, in this process with. We're eating our dog food in this regard. And I'm working with other fund managers to support each other and be in creating a more inclusive environment. And I'll say this, and this is, you know, an important thing. A lot of times with us, especially as women and underrepresented investors, we're competing for such a small pool of people that are like us, right? Because less than 15% of Americans are accredited investors right now. And of that, less than 5% are Black or Latinx, and less than 26% are women. So that's like a small fraction that we're all going to the same people. And because I can't raise from the crowd, you know, and because like we're looking at the same pool that invests in the asset class, you know, it creates an unnecessary competition where we should be cooperating and co-investing in building up this this founder ecosystem to rebuild our economy, especially now.
I agree. And you know, just to kind of piggyback on something you said, so I can think of all the different events and shows I've done, you know, we've done here at Haney Biz, made these investments. And it's not uncommon for us to do panel speakers, or think about who might be coming on our show, or who might we help put on an advisory board. And we think, oh, we need to diversify it. And we have to scratch our head for a second, because we're going back to the same well at some level, because we don't know as many women or Black people that we know could contribute. I'm sure they're there, but we don't know them.
Yeah,
we don't
know who they are.
How do we find
I've been in Sacramento since 2006, and I've been, you know, chasing this, you know, trying to crack this nut for so long, for my whole adult career.
Your phone must ring off the hook, because woman of color, extremely smart, very understand this area better than probably anybody in the community. But I mean, your phone must ring off the hook, partially because you're known, and it's hard for us to know the rest of them. So in terms of that, let's say I'm building out an advisory board. Okay, I want to build out an advisory board for the Sacramento Growth Factory, which or a board of directors. I've already thought you're already on my list to call. So here I am, you know, that's probably no surprise.
I should have worn my shirt that says, we'll work for equity.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, who else? Pay me in equity.
How do we find more people? You know, if I have my portfolio company and they're saying, look, I need to become more successful. Well, let's build out your advisory board. Okay, we want to make sure it's diverse because we know the outcomes are going to become are really going to be better if it's a diverse board. Where do we go? Do we go to you and you point us in the direction, or is there a group
help.
Of people?
Go to Tech Funding Equity, and my phone does not scale, but techfundingequity.com is built to scale.
Okay. Okay.
We're doing some things that don't scale, but yeah. And so like I've included like, you know, booking, I do webinars. You know, if you want to have like your startups, you've invested in 50 startups. If any of them want to avail themselves of the assessment, I'm happy to come and do a webinar for a group of them or within their startups. We have our partners at M-Train and others. Here, you know, you asked a brilliant question. And like I said, when I first came to Sacramento, I didn't know you and you didn't know me. We couldn't find each other. We were in different circles. And that's just, you know, part of the legacy of redlining for one and the way that we grow up. And I'm a mixed chick, okay? But it still kind of happens like that. So, you know, one of the things that I really encourage is, you know, I will go to TechCrunch and I might be the only Black woman in a room, but how often do white men or white people go to a place where they're the only one in the room? You know what I mean? And it's like, for example, I gave this example before, Black Enterprise has this conference that I've contributed to called Tech Connects. And you might look around and see three white people, you know what I mean? And it's not like you're not welcome. It's like, here we are. Where's Black people in tech? Come find us. We know how to party. We'll make you feel right at home. I promise you, there are no robes in our closets at home. I don't know when I go to TechCrunch what I'm working with. I just try to be nice to everyone, give people the benefit of the doubt, but I don't know. But you know, when you come into an environment, I assure you, we have been well-trained to make you feel comfortable. Come on in. We want you there. We want you at the table. And I have a saying at Diversity Ventures, diversity includes you. You know, diversity doesn't mean women and people of color. We focus on that because it's underrepresented. Just like we say Black lives matter, not because other lives don't matter, but because, you know, we're getting the short end of the stick here, right? Mm-hmm. But diversity includes you. So go into places where there are affinity groups, whether it's LGBTQ, if it's Anita Borg, if it's Grace Hopper, mm-hmm. if it's tapping into HBCUs or affinity groups within the campuses that 90% of college students go to that aren't HBCUs, you know, like go outside your comfort zone, because I have to go outside my comfort zone. And guess what? Now I'm comfortable with it. And I enjoy meeting people like you that I would, you know, by sometimes having to be the only one in the room, and we can share then our networks. Right. And that's what people have done. Even when you have countries that married strategically, right. It was to bring peace, to bring countries together. And we can do the same with culture. So those are just some examples. But yeah, I'm absolutely happy. And with the Opportunity Pledge, we've actually put together that framework to help walk people through how they can, capitalize and tap in on diverse perspectives and diverse and inclusive networks. And I'll say this also, because it goes both ways. You know, like I said, when I walk in a room, I don't know who has a hooded cape in their closet. You know what I mean? And so we tend to want to be in places where we feel safe and where we're not going to be subjected to, you know, the toxic experiences that, you know, other people may not be aware that we have to endure. Right. And sometimes when you've been forced to endure, you get frustrated and like you know, sometimes you might look at a person that seems to reflect a group that you associate with oppression and have different kind of feelings. Right. And so it goes both ways, where we have to be very compassionate and empathetic with each other and realizing we have some uncomfortable work to do. But I can assure you, especially as someone who grew up in a mixed family, my mother was white from Klamath Falls, Oregon. My grandma was from West Virginia. They were overtly racist people. My mother was disowned having us. But I tell you, at the end of her life, my grandmother was my best friend. My grandfather, there's no replacing him in my heart. They changed and I've seen people change. And I've seen what it's like when people get comfortable being uncomfortable until it's comfortable. And there's this confidence and this joy. It is so rewarding when you no longer feel kind of threatened or unsure because something is different. When you've exposed yourself, you've had those tough conversations, it is so much fun. And then we can get busy, you know, making money, building our country back up, doing the things we love, solving real problems, because there's not like this awkward thing in the room and this tension. Yeah. You know, around
it's interesting
those things,
because, you know, COVID, there's been some silver linings in COVID. Maybe, I don't know if it's been a step backwards on this front because, I mean, think for example, I was talking to Sonny on his podcast, your husband on his podcast, and was talking about, hey, we need to invite you guys over and hang out a little more. We're diverse in the color of our skin and maybe in other areas, but we got to get to know each other. And my bad, and COVID's bad. And like, hey, you know, we're a little less likely to want to get together face to face where we let our hair down a little bit. And because until we start letting our hair down with each other, it's everything else now is you're sort of protected. You're protective in the way that you give tough love, the way that I might challenge you on a point. It's like, I don't want to be offensive to somebody that might take it the wrong way or something like that. And the more you get to know people, the more they won't take it the wrong way. And COVID is sort of, I think in some ways stopped me, or I've let it stop me. I sound like a victim here. It has stopped me in some ways. My attitude has been be a little more careful on a lot more careful on my face to face, which means haven't got to know people as well in this last, we'll call it 6 or 12 months. And, you know, I probably in some ways have taken a step back on this front where I was making some good progress, I think at some level. And so I'm kind of mad at myself for letting it get in my way. I'm mad at myself for that.
We're seeing that like across a lot of levels. And, you know, when you look at like institutional investors, for example, like LPs, you know, a lot of them are just like, hey, we can't afford not to invest. We've got to keep it moving. And so people are, you know, I'm an empath. So I feel people who aren't even like in my vicinity. You know, I just feel people, you know, but, you know, we're going to have to work through some of that. You know, we're going to have to do other things. We're going to have to adapt, but we as human beings, we're great at adapting. So, you know, I think another benefit of, you know, you mentioned silver linings of the pandemic is it's made us question some of our heuristics. It's difficult for me as a mom and as a woman to fly across the country and meet with LPs, especially when, you know, it might not be a 40 or 50%, but there might be 5% of them that are sexual harassers or put me in, you know, have some, I'm telling you, I've dealt with some things. And so like, you know, not having those face-to-face and experimenting, not like going, you know, crazy and, but, you know, reference checking, doing your diligence, finding other ways to get to know each other. And, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned about letting the hair down, because again, I think that's where we have to allow people to fail forward, just like in startups, right? You fail forward, right? We reinvest in people if they fail the right way, right? Because now you're experienced. And the same is true when it comes to building out our networks. It's okay to make a mistake and say, hey, I don't want to say the wrong thing. Because then when you do say the wrong thing, I'm going to say, well, this is why I'm going to, you know, tell you that I think that might be the wrong thing to say and why, or at least how that makes me feel or what I think of it. And when you set those disclosures and disclaimers early on, and you give each other permission to be candid, to be vulnerable, and you give yourself permission to make mistakes. I make mistakes. I put my foot in my mouth. I make assumptions. I'm human, right? But when you give each other permission, then you can work through that, you know, much, much easier.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe give you a chance to give some closing thoughts, but I have a final question and then we'll have you be able to make some closing thoughts. Mike, as I mentioned, my passion, I love helping veterans with my son being a veteran, a Purple Heart veteran. You know, that's a passion of mine, but the broader passion is my hometown. I grew up here in the Sacramento region and feel like, I feel like investing into Sacramento, my small town, if you will, it's upper underrepresented from a venture capital standpoint, in my opinion. And, you know, so I'm thinking this ecosystem, there's a lot of great people. There's a lot of greatness in this town. There's a lot of great ideas. What, in your mind, stepping back, and I know you're in the middle of this, but you see things from a national and international perspective. You're talking about broader issues that, of course, affect Sacramento. But when you look at Sacramento and the region specifically, what do you see in terms of like key weaknesses or holes in this ecosystem that might tie it all together better?
I agree with you that we have enormous potential and we have enormous influence as well. And so, you know, Sunny's from Botswana and I loved your podcast. I didn't get a chance to tell you, you know, I didn't seize a chance, but you are amazing. And I so appreciate just like your openness. You're always so transparent. And I just respect that so much about you. But you know, with Sunny being from Botswana, you know, I'm privy to some of the business, you know, that every economy, every culture, we want the same things, right? Essentially at our core. And so there, you know, they're trying to grow their local ecosystem too. And yes, you need to invest locally, but you also need to invest externally to bring in revenues that are going to come from seizing those external opportunities. So we need that kind of balance. We need to bring companies in and we need to support the companies that are already here. And if those companies are earlier stage, we need more early stage capital. And absolutely the friends and family round is an incredible barrier. So, you know, I think that here in Sacramento, one of our biggest gaps is what you referenced before. A lot of people who are even, you know, fit under the current criteria of accredited investor, they don't understand the asset class. They're not activated. They're not motivated. I think if there was more, you know, education around that. And when I say education, I really want to say like edutainment, mm-hmm. you know, because it's got to be fun. And I think there's ways that we can make it, you know, fun and where we can show people, like people like to buy, they don't want to be sold. You know, people need to learn, you know, like, how is this going to benefit them? How can they help to close the wealth gap? How can they preserve their capital? You know, everything that they've worked hard for and reduce the risk. And I think, you know, part of that is like being able to invest in diversified offerings, whether you're accredited or not, is one way, right? Like, and it's awkward to talk about money, partially because, you know, especially if you know, you come from a lower income background, there's a shame around it. And when you now say, oh, if you have to make this much to be accredited, and if you don't, you know, now it's another thing that's uncomfortable, because I, you know, if you don't make a lot of money, you have to say, oh yeah, I'm not accredited. And so people kind of have all these negative associations around it. And we've got to talk about it. Just like we talk about, you know, we're starting to talk about culture and racism and things like that. We got to talk about money. We've got to talk about policy, right? And we've got to talk about startups and not just the ones that are the favored few. You know, we've got to create, we've got to democratize access, and it's multifaceted. You can't, again, we can walk and chew gum. We can nurture our young ones and get them up to speed quicker. We can activate. We've got the mentorship program that's going on with, the city, the county and the city of Sacramento, with the partnerships out of the Carlson Center and Startup SAC. I mean, we've got different things going on, but to your point, I think activating our local investors and then also seizing upon, you know, what is available now under the current regulatory framework for non-accredited investors, we need to do that too, mm-hmm. so that we can increase the number of people who are becoming accredited, and we can do that within 10 years.
Yeah. I guess I have one more question too, because this is, if I'm one of these underrepresented founders, maybe somebody who's feels like they're being discriminated against, or maybe being, they haven't been, you know, they didn't grow up as white and privileged as some people. And maybe their parents, I was lucky. My parents were small business people. They weren't accredited investors or anything special, but they were small business people. And so I grew up more open-minded to entrepreneurship. So, okay. So from your perspective, give our audience a little bit of tough love. Okay. Cause I do think that at some level, people need to be told, come on now, you know, there's no excuses, right? I'm sitting here as an investor saying, I want to invest into you more because you're, underrepresented group, or maybe somebody who is a long shot in somebody's eyes. I mean, these are the people that the underestimated people of our world need to get out here and get the, you know, and make it happen. So if you could, in your way, here I am, a white guy, and I want you to call out to any of us underrepresented people out there and say, come on now, go find the SAC Angels, go find Mark Haney, go find these people.
We're looking. And I'll say there's a lot of dynamics at play, but I'll say this, we don't have the same risk capacity because, you know, we're working these full-time jobs. We're told we have to check all these boxes. The bar is higher. And, you know, getting into your network is not as easy as you think. For a long time in Silicon Valley, and VCs were overtly saying, if you can't get a warm intro to me, then you know, you're not worthy of investment. You can't even make a sale into my own network. And, you know, we stood back here and said, hey, your CEOs and your portfolio aren't exactly networking with Black females, you know what I mean, that are in tech. You know, it's like, we're not on the same golf course. We're not playing the same games. We're not having the same discussions. If we're sitting at the bar, they might be hitting on me or ignoring me entirely because they're hitting on someone else. You know what I mean? It's like, there's so many dynamics around the network. So that's one thing. But, you know, yeah, we all need to do a better job of getting outside of our bubbles and our safe places. And we all also need to acknowledge that, you know, first of all, I want to clarify one thing. 70% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. So this is not something that just impacts people of color and women. The fact is, we are disproportionately impacted as women and people of color, right? But the things that I'm proposing, when you do things that benefit women and people of color, you elevate everyone. And we've got this system in place of divide and conquer amongst us that keeps the people who are doing these policies that perpetuate their cronyism and stuff from being accountable to us. So we need to recognize that, yes, it disproportionately impacts some because of our history, but it impacts all of us. And we need to remember that, because the same, you know, fear or angst that a person of color might have about coming into your community, you might see someone with imposter syndrome who grew up in a trailer park, you know, feel about coming to you, right? So there's that part. But, you know, when you do have a little bit more mobility and a little more privilege to assimilate into networks, you know, you have to remember that it's not as easy for other people and that there are other dynamics at play. So I think, you know, especially now that we have things like Zoom and that we're in the pandemic and we're staying home, we can take advantage of opportunities to break down some of these barriers. And we can, you know, look at ways of expanding, even internet access. You look at rural America, there's brilliant people in rural America that don't have equal access to internet that aren't going to be as efficient as me at doing some things, right? So I think we need to look at collectively and individually what we can do and, you know, stop, you know, focusing so much on blaming and looking at, you know, how can we know we have these problems, how can we come together and solve them and accept that it might be uncomfortable, but we're going to hash it out, you know, and we're going to get through it. But yeah, I encourage people of color too. Like, and that's why I say diversity includes you. You know, if you don't have the risk capacity to go and start your own startup, let's get you on somebody else's startup in a C-suite role or, you know, some other early stage position. So you're on a cap table and building wealth to be able to take that risk. Let's pull all the levers. Let's work this complexity out and make a game of it and start having fun making change. And we can heal these wounds.
Pulling all the levers, having fun, making change, healing wounds.
Yep.
Raya Lichtenstern, thank you for inspiring me to give more, to work harder, to not be so shy about entering areas where I don't know people. We just got to put ourselves out there. And that begins with me. I think it begins with all of us. Yeah. Yeah.
We're doing it together. We're in this together. I'm learning. I've learned so much even through this project and the Aspen Tech Policy Hub, both on policy, but even my own history, things I didn't know. And it's our history, right? And so we're in this together. We're learning together. And this is just one step along the way. And I'm looking forward to spending more time with you and looking at ways to partner and do this work together. I really appreciate you.
You bet it. You bet. All right. Thank you, Mariah. I'm not sure when this is going to air, but we'll get you a copy of it. Who knows? You made some great points. And so I think it's going to be a good podcast. So thank you very much. And well, I will be circling around to tell you a little more about the Growth Factory and just, you know, I'd like to have you shoot holes in it, really, because some of the concepts that we have, I think you're going to love in terms of how we might execute the dream. I would love your thoughts on, it doesn't work that way. Here's really how it works.
I ain't shy in that regard. I have tons of opinions and you don't have to like them all, you know, but perfect. I'll share them.
Well, I would love that. I would love your perspective. And we're probably in January. I'll circle back around with you. And how does your January look, by the way? Are you,
mid-January? I've kind of shut some things down to do some heads down work. So, mm-hmm. And I've, you know, have my little way of doing things, but yeah, I'm taking some breathing space to get some projects done, but mid-January I'll be opening my calendar back up. And
okay. After mid-January. Yeah. Okay. Perfect. I will, you know, Monique and Rick and my teammates, so we'll probably,
yeah. It's so reflective of the leadership. People like you and Cameron Law, I just love how everything that you touch is just like, I know we're all human beings. None of us are perfect, but man, your culture is amazing. I can help take, you know, notch it up just a little bit more, I'd be glad to do my little part just to be associated with y'all.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you very much. I truly appreciate that and appreciate everything you've already done. But the fact that we can talk about the Growth Factory and maybe partnering with some of the things that you're doing, that sounds fun.
Yay. We're going to have fun. We're going to party.
All right. Sounds good. All right. I'm going to go take my dog to the vet. It needs its shot. We have a puppy. COVID brought a puppy to our family, which we're
excited about.
Would you have a cat?
And two outside cats, one of which I think has cancer, unfortunately.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go.
That's right. We gonna love them, you know, like that. We all have one exit route, man, animal or whatever. But guess what? We going to make the best of this time here.
That's the right attitude. Yes. All right. Well, thanks again. And we'll talk soon. Okay.
All right. Take care.
All right. Thanks,
bye.
Mary. Bye.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Great show today. I think Mariah said it well when she talked about more people being enabled to join the investment process. And that's what we're doing here at Haney Biz with the launch of our Sacramento Growth Factory. It's impact investing for early stage companies, for seed stage companies, to try to help these founders, these entrepreneurs, get from seed stage to Series A or to a point where they're bankable. But really, going a little bit more hands-on than a typical angel investor might do, more hands-on than what a venture capital firm might do, where we go in and we're trying to help them get from sort of point A to point B. In this particular case, it's to get that next round of financing. So if you have questions about how to become an angel investor, how to join the Sacramento Growth Factory, how to become one of these successful entrepreneurs that takes their company from point A to point B and beyond, hit me up. Follow me on Instagram @TheMarkHaney. Follow me on LinkedIn. You know where to find me. I'm down here at Haney Biz. We have a co-working hub. We have a place where the entrepreneurial community gets together and figures out how to help each other succeed. It's entrepreneurs helping entrepreneurs. So just to everybody out there that's fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship, for all those fighting the good fight for keeping our country and our community safe, you know that here at Haney Biz, we are never above you, never below you, but always by your side.